I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What we know about our presidential race, 90 days from the finish, perhaps all anyone knows, is that a wounded Donald Trump will not go quietly if he goes at all, if he does not invoke emergency powers to cancel the election. Here's a quick sample of the full Trump in the interview ring this week with Jonathan Swan of Axios. He's still playing the strong man, trashing voting procedures, defending roundups of anti-fascist crazies by an unmarked U.S. military force that has since retreated from the streets of Portland, Oregon. And then he tops even himself in surreal self-praise.
Somebody got a ballot for a dog. Somebody got a ballot for something else. You got millions of ballots going. Nobody even knows where they're going. You look at some of the corruption having to do with universal mail-in voting. Absentee voting is okay. You have to apply. You have to go through a process.
You have to apply for mail-in.
Absentee voting is good. I think Antifa should be investigated, not the law enforcement. They're investigated.
They shouldn't be investigating.
Have you been watching television? I did more for the black community than anybody, with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln, whether you like it or not. People say, oh, that's
you really, you believe you did more than Lyndon Johnson, who passed the Civil Rights Act?
I think I did, yeah.
Our guest, Marsha Gessen, has a term, Trump's word piles, for rapid-fire outbursts like that. The thought this hour was, and still is, to draw out the astute Russian and American diagnostician Marsha Gessen, a resistance figure in two countries, with a new book titled Surviving Autocracy, and we will get to it. But then the plot thickened, particularly around the mayhem in Oregon after federal shock troops had landed, over the objections of state governor, city mayor, and a militant wall of moms. A gray but lonely warning turned up in a New York Times guest opinion piece. It was written by the sometime Colorado senator and presidential candidate, Gary Hart, a Democrat, arguing that the true danger in Portland is President Trump's notion of his own unlimited personal authority. So I called Gary Hart on the phone at his cabin a few mountains away from Denver. Gary, of course, I read your piece in the Times. For people who've stopped listening to every single Trump utterance, the lines you quoted were shockers, like this one. When somebody is president of the United States, the authority is total, and that's the way it's got to be. Who's going to do something about this?
Well, one hopes Congress will, under pressure from the American people, when they find out that these secret powers have been around for decades, and no one anticipated that they might be available to a president such as we have today. They were first concocted during the Cold War and the Eisenhower years under the remote possibility that we might be subject to a nuclear attack. And the question was, who governs America and under what conditions? So proclamations and executive orders and instantaneously passed legislation set up a situation that is virtually a blueprint for dictatorship. Hmm. And those powers have been expanded in every administration since then.
Today, Gary Hart, what are the exercises of secret power that you worry about most?
All the president has to do is declare a national emergency. This president has declared 7 national emergencies. Hmm. But the secret powers provide that if a president declares a national emergency, all these powers are available. Now, based upon research done by the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School, these include suspension of habeas corpus, a centerpiece of all democracy, searches and seizures without a judicial warrant, as required by the 4th Amendment, mass arrests for no declared reason, and we began to see that in Portland, and declaration of martial law unilaterally. So it's virtually a suspension of the Constitution.
Remind me, what are the emergencies that he felt justified in declaring? I mean, not nuclear attack, obviously.
I think the principal one had to do with erecting the wall on the Mexican border He used emergency powers to send troops down there that were not needed. He also got legislation passed that enabled him to dispatch unidentified federal forces to Portland and now to several other cities under an order for protection of federal property. Well, that's led, as you know, to all kind of mischief.
Gary, you and Walter Mondale are the last survivors of the Church Committee, famous effort almost 50 years ago to check these sort of things. It was news then that the secret wiretapping of Martin Luther King Jr., for example, had gone on at great length. Also that organized crime had penetrated the Kennedy White House in the form of a mafia girlfriend. Assassinations abroad, like Patrice Lumumba, for example, other attempts. How many people in Congress today are prepared to challenge this practice as Frank Church and his committee were?
Well, who gets the credit historically for that was not Senator Church, but Mike Mansfield, who was majority leader of the Senate.
Montana Democrat, great man, yep.
And it was as a result of disclosures that were coming out about efforts undertaken by the CIA and other intelligence services. Senator Mansfield, as majority leader, had the determination to let the American people know about this. And so for the first time since the start of the Cold War in 1946-7, Congress exercised its authority to oversee the intelligence services of the United States. And it was in the course of our hearings that we discovered the assassination plots, overthrow of foreign governments, and involvement by the CIA with mafia figures to kill Fidel Castro at a time that John Kennedy was himself assassinated.
In relatively recent days, the secret snooping that Edward Snowden revealed went vastly beyond, in terms of numbers of Americans observed, anything the Frank Church Committee saw or prevented. I mean, how much of this stuff still goes merrily onward?
I have no way of knowing. I haven't been in Congress for over 30 years. All I know is that the Church Committee documents have not been fully released, and I don't know when they are scheduled to be released, but they should be right away.
Everybody's unhappy about the Portland, Oregon model. Mayor of Chicago has said, don't try it here, pal. But is anybody doing anything about it? Everybody notices the resemblance to American special forces acting, say, in Haiti, or as Trump would love to do, in Venezuela. We do it abroad, and we're shocked to see it happening here. But who's doing anything about it?
I think the congressional delegation from Oregon and elected officials there are outraged, as are the citizens. The same is true of the city government in Chicago, where the troops are headed. And I think it's true in almost every city where they're headed. Whether it's being reported or not is a separate issue.
It's so obviously not the American way. I want to come back, though, to exactly our standards. Benjamin Franklin famously told a woman who asked him what they'd accomplished in the Constitutional Convention. He said, "We've given you a republic, madam, if you can keep it." Over the years, Gary Hart, I must say, you have been articulate on what those Republican virtues, Republican mindsets are all about.
If you stop 10 citizens outside your studio and ask them what kind of government we have, 9 at least would say a democracy. Yet the history of the founding of this nation, all the founders used the language of the republic. That's because they had read the Roman philosophers. And one of the centerpieces of a republic since Rome has been what they called civic virtue. Yes. Today we call it civic involvement, participation, and yet we salute the flag of a republic, and 60% of Americans don't vote, let alone go to city council meetings or participate in the public life of our nation. What Franklin was saying about keeping the republic is if you don't participate, you will lose the republic. And if I were to be asked to summarize my political philosophy, it would be to keep your rights under a democracy, you must perform your duties as a republic. The republic is about duties. Democracy is about rights.
How close to real danger are we by your measure?
Well, I would put it this way, Chris. I would be terrified, but not totally surprised to wake up in the morning and the president of the United States, trailing badly in the polls, has declared a serious national emergency and assumed all those powers that are there waiting for him to use. That's how afraid I am. This president's the worst word he can say about anyone is loser. Do you think he wants to be a loser? I don't think so.
If you woke up on such a morning, what would you do? What would you expect your country to do?
I would expect millions of Americans to take to the streets, including around the White House. I would expect patriots in the Congress to do everything they can to negate that. I would expect the Joint Chiefs of Staff to refuse to take orders under those conditions.
The generals, God love them, have already sort of signaled that that walk through Lafayette Park was a giant mistake and they wouldn't do it again.
Yes. Good sign.
Are the spooks ready? The press is ready, I have to say.
He will shut down the press.
Wow.
Including your program.
What would it take to undo such a declaration of emergency?
Prevent it from happening in the first place. That's why I wrote the article and why I'm continuing to try to get public attention on this threat before we wake up and find out it's too late.
Gary, you've said it incredibly well. I'm proud to know you, man. Thank you, Gary Hart. It's one of your really wonderful moments.
Well, I've had some great experiences, including getting to know some of America's best people, and that includes you.
Thank you, Gary. It's very sweet. Coming up, the former Harvard Law Dean Martha Minow, and then Marsha Gessen. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Martha Minow, 40 years a professor at the Harvard Law School, is credentialed and also, as an ex-dean, outspoken. I asked her this week for a take on rights and wrongs in Portland.
So I have a daughter in her 20s who said to me and my husband, there are people being taken from unmarked cars off the streets in Portland, and it turns out they're government agents. And this was 6 weeks ago, and Joe and I both said, oh, that can't be. And within the next week, the stories emerged. So thank goodness for 20-something people who are engaged and using social media to watch what's going on in the world. You know, I have been an observer of autocracies and tyrannies around the world, and I actually think it looks a lot like scenes that we have seen in other countries and that I deplore, whether it's Argentina during the Dirty War or other places around the world. Now, it's not quite so bad. People have been released. It seems to be more about a PR move than it is about actually making people disappear. But it has all the elements of secrecy, untrained agents, and response to fear and the effort to produce fear. That's the big point. The effort to produce fear among a civilian population.
Draw the line between this and, say, federal troops enforcing civil rights laws.
Sure. So Little Rock, Arkansas comes to mind, for example, though it was actually, you know, the state militia that was commandeered by the president. Look, where there is a court order that is public, and that mobilizes the duly elected officials who in turn make a public order to enforce a court order in public with trained officials who are not in unmarked cars and who are not secretly absconding with people. It's a very, very different story in every one of those dimensions.
It seems also a blatant contradiction of states' rights at an unimaginable level.
You know, I think the issues are very, very complicated. Of course, there are federalism issues, but we are one country and the federal government is supreme. I think the bigger issue here is actually the creation, largely by Congress, of emergency powers granted to the executive branch of the federal government, and the ability, therefore, of the president to declare an emergency and invoke over 100 powers, distinct powers. That's the big problem. And a related problem, obviously, is the presence of a president who really doesn't care about any limits on power.
Martha Minow, I'm interested in your take, especially because you're sometime dean of the Harvard Law School at the pinnacle of the American legal establishment. Where are the lawyers? Where is the ABA? Where are our unquestioned authorities, if we have any?
Well, I am no longer dean, and therefore I'm able to speak, which is a very good thing. And, you know, when I say I'm no longer the dean so I can speak out, I mean, I think that's a very interesting comment about the changes in academic leadership now compared to, for example, even during the Japanese-American internment period, where the president of the University of Chicago, as president, not only spoke out, but created a program to admit Japanese and Japanese-American interned youth to come to the University of Chicago and other participating colleges. But the modern universities, the current era, leadership tends to confine their public statements to matters that they perceive as directly affecting the business of the college or university. And I think that's a loss. That's a loss of moral authority at a time when, in fact, we have a diminution of respected moral authorities across all sectors.
Martha, go very basic here. How is the Constitution faring here, the rule of law, as everybody understands it?
I think that it's fragile. The Constitution creates a set of complicated structures that allow ambitious people to pursue good in their own minds and then counterbalance one another. Ambition should counteract ambition was James Madison's conception, and that's the separation of powers in the federal government, and that's the federalism, the relationship between the national government and the states. But none of it works if there isn't a spirit of liberty and a defense vigilantly defended by the people. None of it works. And in their recent major book, Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson do a survey of nations across time, across societies, and find that constitutions per se are only one part of the equation. If you don't have an active civil society, including protests, including journalists, including people who demand the enforcement of rights and their respect, doesn't matter how beautiful the document is. In addition, we, of course, depend on individuals to enforce the Constitution in the formal system, and that's judges and prosecutors and grand juries. And we have seen in the federal government, you know, the biggest success of Donald Trump is the appointment of federal judges at a pace that's never been seen before. And so all around the country, federal courts are delicately balanced between individuals who were appointed by Republicans and individuals appointed by Democrats. And Donald Trump is constantly demeaning the courts and politicizing them and calling the judges simply by the name of the party that appointed them. This puts into ill repute the respect for law, and not to mention their own backbone. I think the Chief Justice of the United States is keenly aware of this. One of his rare moments of speaking out publicly, talk about using the bully pulpit for moral authority, was to reject Donald Trump's appellation, his naming of judges based on the political affiliation of the president who appointed them. But therefore, you have a Chief Justice who is himself sitting on a court that is delicately balanced.
Martha, come back to that spirit of liberty, common sense level, street level. I wonder who's speaking up for it in this context. Portland in general, but I'm thinking of Stephen Calabresi, a right-wing legal authority who said Donald Trump should be impeached even for suggesting a cancellation of the presidential election. That was sort of cross politics, but it spoke any civilian's notion. It's a crazy, impossible thing to suggest.
Well, even Mitch McConnell spoke out against it, and we'll see how long.
He didn't say it was impeachable. He said it was a bad idea.
He spoke out against it, and let's see how long his stamina persists. But I, right now, I would be looking not at elected officials, but at civil society. And by that, I mean organizations. The people who are standing up for the spirit of liberty are Black Lives Matter leaders, are young people who are protesting, and some older gray-haired people who are joining in. And, you know, when people say they're worried about street protests because it's disorder.
Exactly.
Well, I can only say that that is in the greatest tradition of America. How did the revolution start? Except by protests, whether it was Thomas Paine, but it was also people in the streets. Think about the Tea Party in the Boston Harbor. It is dependent on this spirit of liberty of people as individuals and in groups who insist on respect for their individual rights and respect for the polity as a whole. That is what makes it possible to breathe life into rights that are beautiful in the Constitution, but mean nothing. And here's just another reason why I'll say that. After the Civil War, when the Constitution was finally amended to eliminate slavery, and to protect the life, liberty, and property of each individual and their equal protection, it was the United States Supreme Court that systematically took apart the scope of those new amendments. Well documented, for example, in Eric Foner's wonderful recent book, The Second Founding.
Yes.
Unless you have people who are insisting on the preservation and durability of rights, the institutions can consolidate power and suppress them and undermine them. And of course, that's short-term, but also long-term, because elections have consequences. Elections influence who are the officials and who put in place the building blocks that made it possible 20, 30 years after the adoption of those amendments to have them shrunk to almost nothing. Mm.
Martha, what are the formal remedies here for a man who is clearly testing the limits, not even the limits of the law, testing what he could get away with?
Well, elections are the major sanction that we have. There's never been a more significant election in the United States than the one coming up in November. It's called the electoral sanction by political scientists for that reason. The other technique of impeachment has been tried and did not succeed. Judicial review of individual decisions, you know, problematic. The upholding of Trump versus Hawaii, the upholding of the Muslim ban, the so-called Muslim ban, actually includes explicit language written by the Chief Justice that says we really shouldn't look at the racist and Islamophobic statements made by Donald Trump. You can't count on the courts. You can't count on the courts. It's an important check. Individually, some cases will be important, but ultimately it's elections, elections, elections.
But just wait just a minute. I mean, if perchance Donald Trump got himself reelected, does that mean he wins the argument? The electoral sanction works against us now?
If Donald Trump secures a continuation in office by subverting the election with fraud and suppression of voting, shutting down the post office, refusing to actually comport with the actual returns, or otherwise allowing manipulation, whether by outside forces or his own, it does not vindicate him. It is only underscores how vulnerable our institutions are. The warning signs of tyranny, the key warning signs of tyranny include control of the media by authoritarians, interference with elections, interference with opposing parties, interference with any expertise, any source of authority contrary to the plutocrat or the demagogue in power. Those are the warning signs. And, you know, as someone who's studied these issues in Eastern Europe, in Africa, in South America, I can only say for the last certainly 4 years, but I would say longer, the last 6 to 10 years, we have seen growing worries. And now it's thunderous. So that's the worry that I have. And it is one that goes specifically to whether or not the election that's upcoming will be at all fair.
I'm worried about the electoral sanction. Would he not say that the electoral sanction from 2016 authorized him to do everything he's done so far, beyond legal reproach or stopping?
Oh, I mean, he has said that, and he's also said that he has more powers than anybody knows.
Right.
But he said many, many, many things.
Too many.
And Lawrence Douglas has written a recent chilling book called Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown of 2020. You know this book. Unfortunately, the questions of what Donald Trump will lay claim to in the past are much less worrisome than what he will lay claim to in the future.
Martha, I think we've been off our game ever since the United States Supreme Court selected George Bush as president. But connect us to that departure, and how much further have we strayed?
The integrity of U.S. elections is far from adequate. And Bush v. Gore exposed not only the problems with hanging chads and voting machines, but also the problems with leaving control of the voting process in the hands of elected state officials. There has been progress in ensuring integrity of voting machines and a backup paper record. What there has not been, in most places, improvement of the politicized nature of the state control of the election process.
Sandra Day O'Connor, a Reagan appointee to the Supreme Court, said late in life it was a wrong vote for Bush. It was a wrong case for the Supreme Court to take. I mean,
yes, I think that she looked back and she had regrets. I can't get into her mind, but I do have the belief that some of the justices thought it was a very politicized effort. Some others thought that they were doing a service to the nation by halting the uncertainty. I think at this moment, the risk of uncertainty following our November election is huge. COVID-19 alone disrupting the ability of people to go and vote in person. But then you add to it the deliberate efforts in many states to suppress the votes of people who are likely to be Democratic voters. This is not bipartisan suppression. This is in one direction. That is a serious concern, and the confusion, some of it just accidental, that's arriving as states run to try to use mail-in ballots when they haven't done it before, haven't tested the process, and the voters haven't used it before. New York is a great example. New York, in a recent election, had people who had always voted and used mail having their votes rejected because their return address used a spouse name or other kinds of technical problems. And New York quickly adopted legislation to allow individuals to correct incorrect elements of their mail-in ballots. Other states are not being so careful and vigilant. So I think the risk of disorder and confusion is huge. And that is, for me, why the work of nonpartisan organizations such as the Campaign Legal Center are so crucial. Efforts that are just devoted to making sure everybody can fairly vote and have their vote count. I think this is number one priority.
Sandra Day O'Connor's retrospective view was not that the decision in Bush v. Gore was wrong, but that the Supreme Court had no business entering into the decision. It's not for the Supreme Court to pick a president. And I think that makes a lot of sense to people now.
The structure that gives state courts the power to oversee elections had the state Supreme Court of Florida overseeing the counting of votes there. The mistake that Sandra Day O'Connor, Justice O'Connor, is reflecting upon was the Supreme Court of the United States accepting a request for it to intervene rather than to allow the lower court's process to continue. Hmm. That was a mistake. And as someone who herself had been a state court judge, it's a surprising mistake on her part.
Martha, you're wonderful. Sum it up.
This is an urgent time for the spirit of liberty and respect for human dignity to emerge with full force and loud roar from people going into the streets, but most of all, voting and making their voice heard. And Chris, thank you for your leadership and making sure people have a voice.
I'm just listening with more and more dismay, Martha Minow. Thank you enormously for this conversation.
Thank you so much for what you're doing, and stay well, stay safe, and stay sane.
Coming up, Marsha Gessen, finally, on the all-consuming power figure, alone on his stage before an audience transfixed in fear and anger. It's the Gessen picture of Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Marsha Gessen has been an activist, oppositionist star in two cultures. Born in Moscow, raised since mid-teens in Greater Boston, back and forth ever since. Face-to-face with President Putin in Moscow on issues of the environment and press controls, and now week-to-week in President Trump's face in The New Yorker, online and in print. Marsha Gessen's new book of TART, original reporting and commentary, is Surviving Autocracy.
In this book, I use terminology that is proposed by a Hungarian sociologist and political scientist named Balint Magyar.
Yes.
He's an amazing thinker.
Yes.
He's one of those very few people I read just to make myself feel like the world can make sense.
Hmm.
And so he has written this incredible book called Anatomy of Post-Communist Regimes, which proposes a really detailed understanding of these different transformations on the road away from what might have been democracy. And he proposes that there are three different stages: autocratic attempt, autocratic breakthrough, and autocratic consolidation. And I think it's incredibly illuminating when you apply it to the United States. And it fits much better than I would like it to fit. But the difference between autocratic attempt and the stages that follow is that while we're in an autocratic attempt, it's reversible by electoral means, meaning we can still vote Trump out of office.
We think, yeah.
It is starting to look more and more difficult. He has signaled very clearly that he's planning to not recognize the results of the election if he loses. He's also signaled very, very clearly that he's going to do everything in his power to disrupt or destroy the election. And yet we still have that possibility of getting rid of him through electoral means. So we're in the autocratic attempt stage.
Same writer, Balint Magyar, and you have popularized this very plausible idea that we're living under some sort of mafia politics, Capone or John Gotti style, a monomaniacal focus on pleasing the leader. Trump's the planner, he's the phrase maker, he's the performer, he's the praise giver, the play-by-play announcer. Everything comes from one person for one person. And he revealed almost all of it in the 16 campaign. You write he was probably the first major party nominee who ran not for president, but for autocrat. And he won. Still sort of unfathomable, as you say. How did he do it?
He didn't hide much from us, did
True.
He? He told us how he was going to govern. He told us what he wanted to do. It's fascinating to me that we humans, and this does seem to be true of a lot of humans, not just Americans, we have an almost unbounded ability to refuse to believe things that are in plain view, but that are hard for us to believe intellectually or emotionally or that make the imagination stumble. When Trump was telling us that he was going to run this country like a mafia boss, when he was telling us that he was going to build a wall, when he was telling us that he was going to ban Muslims from coming into the country, when he was telling us that he was going to destroy government as we know it, we kind of refused to listen.
At several points, especially now Portland, Oregon, he has created what feels like a state of exception. He even declared a national emergency around building the wall with Mexico. A state of exception, as in what the Reichstag fire did for Hitler in 1933. Have we seen our state of exception yet?
You know, this is where I try to be careful. And this may sound strange coming from me, considering that I talk so much about Trump. But, you know, I think that we really have to understand Trump in the context of what came before Trump. He is unlike any president who has come before him. But the groundwork was certainly laid. And I say this in response to your question about the state of exception, because I think we really have to face how much of a state of exception we had created after 9/11, and how much that state of exception facilitated the emergence of Donald Trump. I wouldn't say it created Donald Trump, but I would say that it made Donald Trump possible. Mm. You know, we have had a state of emergency since September 12th, 2001, that was renewed 8 times by President Obama. And it was under that state of emergency, both legal and psychological, that we created the domestic surveillance state, that we created a new American identity as a nation under siege, as a nation under attack. And we created DHS, whose goons are now rounding up protesters in Portland and getting ready to attack whoever Trump declares to be the enemy of the people next, right? DHS came into being after 9/11.
I'd underline that by saying that state of emergency also created a war in Iraq that everybody now rues, and it created a resistance that thought it was voting against a lot of that when it voted for Trump.
I think you're right. I think it exacerbated a kind of dysfunction and distrust in the system that also made Trump possible, yes.
Marcia Gessner, I want you to speak about the Putin connection, because you've written endlessly about Putin. You've dealt with Putin, so to speak, in Russia as a journalist. And also you resisted the fashionable Russiagate reading and the line that Putin got Trump elected and somehow controls him. But you also say there's a curious resemblance between the two figures. Explain what you can of that.
It's confusing, isn't it?
No, it's fascinating.
It's funny. I have almost come full circle, because I used to be the one who was running around saying, you're underestimating Putin. He's really a villain. He really wants to launch a war against the West. You know, he's as bad an actor on the Russian political scene or in the world political scene as we have seen. And then once people started saying, oh, he's the great mastermind who created Trump and is taking over the world, I kept saying, you know, what, are you crazy? It's not just that I'm a contrarian. It's that I think that one of the most difficult things to face about both Putin and Trump is that they're not masterminds of anything. They're not any kind of evil genius. They are horrible people. They're opportunists. They are interested only in money and power. They don't seem to have any moral judgment or aspiration. But they're not brilliant. They don't have a master plan. And they're just like dragging us into the abyss in a kind of stumbling way, not in a brilliantly planned way. And I think the only thing that's harder for people to imagine, that's scarier for people to imagine than being dragged into the abyss by an evil genius, is just like falling into the abyss, because we're that stupid. But I'm not a Russian interference denialist. We have ample documentation of Russian meddling, but I'm much more inclined to think of it as a kind of trolling, right? And it's the kind of trolling that hasn't evolved much in the more than half a century that Russia has been trying to meddle in American politics, but it fell in fertile soil during the 2016 election. And that means we really have to be looking at ourselves. Also, we have, no matter how much evidence of Russian interference we're ever going to assemble, we're never going to be able to calculate whether it actually played a definitive role in Trump's victory, right? He won by 77,000 votes. Anything could have played a definitive role. But what we really need to be thinking about is that there were 60 million Americans who voted for him. And for the vast majority of them, Russians had nothing to do with it. Americans elected Trump. He's our creation. And that's what we need to be thinking about.
But about the bond between them or the shared DNA or whatever, you quote Tim Snyder in April 2016, when the campaign was just getting serious. He said, "It's not hard to see why Trump might choose Putin as his fantasy friend. Putin is the real world version of the person Trump pretends to be on television."
Yeah, I think that was beautifully put. I mean, Trump has never met an autocrat that he didn't admire. He seems to develop affection for them. I mean, he talked about falling in love with Kim Jong Un. I think that he has a very basic understanding of power as a sort of performance, as a performance of control and raw power. He sees power as he imagines power functions, right? And that inspires a kind of envious admiration in him, I think. I don't think that there is a particular affinity between Trump and Putin that I wouldn't find looking at his admiration for another leader.
Masha, you're wonderful on language. What terrible effect he's had on our own public language. He's virtually silenced any substantive discussion about what government is supposed to do. You never hear him say, well, this is my view about, you know, real security or any kind of social understanding, and he's almost blocked the rest of us from thinking about it. He has closed down real conversation, real public conversation in this country. Can you explain that?
You know, it's really extraordinary how little it took for us to stop having any kind of substantive discussion. I mean, it's not that particularly American public conversation was ever very rich. I think a lot of us, when we go to European countries, are struck by how much public discussion is really kind of an open-ended conversation.
Right. Tony Judt, another wonderful foreign commentator on us, referred to our dilapidated public conversation. That was 20 years ago. So robust American speech, we think of it as one of the great natural treasures.
Yes, and Trump has taken us another five notches down. He's done it in a few different ways. One is just, I think, by flooding the zone, as his former advisor Steve Bannon said. But yeah, by creating this kind of static in the information sphere that makes it impossible to focus, that makes it impossible to fix any one subject of conversation and stay with it. I mean, even with the pandemic, which is as close to a common problem as this country has had in probably 100 years.
Yep.
Even with that, we can't have any kind of focused, sustained conversation. He's also succeeded in creating this kind of inability to focus by creating a state of anxiety. You know, people who are anxious can't focus. Mm-hmm. People who are anxious can't think about the future. People who are anxious can't go into any depth. We're always afraid of missing something else that's happening. We're always discombobulated by another piece of news. He has also done this by lying. And he has a very particular kind of lying, which this is one of the ways in which I think he and Putin are substantially similar, which is that they use what I think of as the power lie. It's not the kind of lie that's intended to make you think something you don't already think, right? It's not intended to make you believe that the dog ate my homework. It's intended to communicate to you that I will say whatever I want whenever I want to. And what are you going to do about it?
Can I quote you a wonderful line on it? You say the Trumpian lie is different. It's the power lie or the bully lie, the lie of the bigger kid who took your hat and is wearing it while denying that he took it. There's no defense because the point of the lie is to show power. Well said, Masha Gessen.
Thank you, Chris.
There's another point that's more unusual in your book. Language has eroded, but so, for a long time, has moral authority. Here's your observation. for a number of years, perhaps since the end of the Cold War, the language of ideals and principles has been fading from American political discourse, giving way to the language of realism and action and markets, I would add. President Obama, in his farewell speech, leaving the presidency, framed American history, and you didn't like it, in terms of purpose rather than vision, idea, or yearning. I have to say, in the funeral and mourning for John Lewis, you hear the language of ideals, of struggle, a bigger purpose restored by Obama's own funeral oration for John Lewis, also by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What is that story of vanished aspiration in American oratory?
You know, somewhere along the way, and I think it actually, the process began long before the end of the Cold War, but it accelerated after the end of the Cold War. And this is especially true, I think, of the Democratic Party. We sort of transitioned to this understanding of politics as good management. We're not electing a leader to take us into a glorious future. We're electing the firefighter-in-chief, the accountant-in-chief, but not the storyteller-in-chief, not the visionary-in-chief. Mm-hmm. If you listen to, you know, Democratic debates, they increasingly center on issues of competence. And in fact, you know, Hillary Clinton tried to run against Donald Trump on competence. And I think she was convinced at the last that showing the public that he was incompetent was going to get her elected. And I think that's a fundamental misapprehension of what politics is for, right? And what political leadership ought to be. I think political leadership ought to be a portal to the future.
Yeah.
Political speech should make you feel, at least for a minute, that you could wake up in a different world and love it. And maybe feel less anxious than you do when you wake up now.
Marcia Gessen, you argue throughout this book, Surviving Autocracy, that institutions will not save us, not even our structure of government and law. Also, that there's no going back, and beware of people who want to take you back. But your book is also full of vision and aspiration and hope. Spell it out.
Okay, so let me start with the institutions. And this is, I think, a very peculiarly American trait. Americans have an almost religious faith in our institutions. And by that, I mean that we imbue them with some magical qualities. We imbue them with the quality of self-repair. And of course, that's not how institutions work. They're not self-repairing, and they're not independent, and they only work in as much as we enable them to work and have a shared understanding of how they work, right? Which is what's made it so easy for Trump to trample them, to diminish them, and in some ways to just ignore them. And I think that perhaps if we do vote him out of office, as we enter a post-Trump future, we should take away the lesson that we have to reinvent ourselves all the time. That's what democracy is, right? Democracy is not a thing that you build and inhabit. Democracy is an aspiration. It's a negotiation. It's an invention. It's a way to constantly keep coming up with ways to actually create a government of the governed. Mm. That's work that we haven't done in a long, long time. And it's way overdue.
I took that as the theme of President Obama's funeral oration, or the spirit of John Lewis's life and work.
I think you're absolutely right. That was one of the most visionary and kind of daring speeches that Obama ever gave, very much in the spirit of John Lewis.
Marcia Gessen, can't thank you enough for every piece you write in The New Yorker, also for this book, Surviving Autocracy, and for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks also to Martha Minow and Gary Hart. Please think of supporting Open Source by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you will find a growing audio library, including Adam Coleman's ongoing series of interviews about reading in a time of social distance. This week, novelist and essayist Laila Lalami, whose new book, Conditional Citizens, asks big questions about belonging and xenophobia in the U.S. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman, with help from Mike Garth. Mary McGrath is our surviving autocrat. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.